This week, you may have heard red and processed meat was deemed a carcinogen or probable carcinogen by the World Health Organization, and an author on our program seemed to chuckle.
From my perspective as a historian, this notion that red meat and processed meats cause cancer, this has been around and peddled since the 1970s.
That's Maureen Ogle, author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Her point that, once again, nutritional science is crying wolf. The wolf idea here is apt because, like an ancient wolf howl, humans are not likely to scamper away from their ancient meat-eating ways any more than they're likely to give up on grease and sugar, even if some tantalizingly simple diet comes along. Listen.
Hi, it's Rosie from Vancouver, Washington, and I've tried the cabbage soup diet. It was delicious. It was so delicious till I started to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches along with it. Then I upgraded to grilled cheese sandwiches. So it really did defeat the purpose, but the soup was amazing.
Amazing. Thanks for that, Rosie, and good luck on the next diet. Perhaps the reason simple diets and simple nutritional directives often fail is that they miss how complicated our digestive systems are, how strong our predilections are for certain types of food, and that makes almost all nutritional science feel dubious and hard to follow confidently. Well, how does David Katz feel? He's a physician and founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. He spent a lifetime studying nutrition. David Katz, is it too complicated a system to make any definitive conclusions about, and are we stuck with our wolf-like ways when it comes to meat?
John, good to be with you. Rosie's take on the cabbage soup diet is really unique. I've never heard anything quite like that before. No, John, we're not hopelessly befuddled. I routinely point out we are not clueless about the basic care and feeding of Homo sapiens. And for folks who are inclined to think, well, okay, you know, meat is bad, but then we just heard someone say not so fast, and so we can't really trust anything and we're very confused. You know, we could pause for a moment and think about the fact that most of us have visited a zoo at some point in our lives, and we're fairly confident in the notion that all of the animals in the zoo get fed. And we might ask ourselves, how could that possibly be? How could we know anything about what to feed sea lions or lions, for that matter, and have absolutely no idea what to feed ourselves? So the notion that we're clueless about all this is extremely far-fetched and, in fact, anathema to public health because diet is so important to health. But there are a lot of subtleties. One of the great problems, John, it's entirely your fault, actually.
Oh, thank you for that.
I don't mean you personally, but you know, the media. We take scientific studies and we sort of throw them at the public every day in the media as if science were a ping-pong match. It's this way, it's that way, it's this way, it's that way. But those of us who actually are scientists looking on, we never thought that way in the first place. We take each new study and add it to everything we thought we knew before. And we ask the question, does this obligate us to change what we thought we knew before, or does this add to it or refine it in some way? So science accumulates incrementally over a long period of time. It's evolutionary, not revolutionary. But evolutionary doesn't work very well for these rapid news cycles of ours. So, you know, the public feels like we're changing our minds all the time. In fact, we're not.
Let me grab the evolutionary idea for a moment in the sense that, do you have greater challenges for a species like an omnivore, a Homo sapiens, where patterns of dietary behavior certainly produce very different physiological consequences depending on where and what you eat over a long period of time, and that the length of time that we're living today, it's sometimes hard to pin a particular outcome in someone's 80s on a dietary pattern of their 20s and 30s, or is it not so challenging?
Well, you queued up a whole lot of very challenging things there, John, and I totally agree with you. So, for instance, the relationship between both dietary pattern and, for that matter, adiposity, body fat, and breast cancer more and more looks like it's one that plays out with a long gap in time in between. So it may matter a lot what young girls, young women eat and what they weigh in terms of their breast cancer risk much later in life. And yes, it becomes much harder to connect dots that are separated by decades. You know, our brains aren't even wired that way. We see cause and effect in savanna terms, you know, the wolf pack that chases their prey and catches it, or when we did the same. It's also complicating things when we think about our adaptations to diet. Most anthropologists agree that our Stone Age lifespan was about half of what it is today. Well, it may be that eating more meat is a better thing when you're not likely to live much past 40 and you need big muscles and you're going to spend your life hunting and gathering and you don't have to worry about long-term effects. And the net effects on the population may be very different today. So even what we can learn from evolutionary biology and adaptation, and clearly we are constitutionally an omnivorous species, but what does that mean when we've changed our relationship to the natural world, taken matters into our own hands, and can expect now to live 8 decades rather than 4 or 9 decades? And then, you know, frankly, we want to look at real-world experience and say, what does that tell us? And speaking of living 10 decades, the best information we have about that is courtesy of the world's Blue Zones, the work of Dan Buettner. These are the populations around the world where people most routinely do live to be 100. And in fact, in all instances, they eat very little meat. They eat mostly plant-based diets. But they also avoid highly processed, glow-in-the-dark food. You know, the report that's just out from IARC and WHO is telling us that processed meat is carcinogenic and that we ought to reduce our intake of red meat overall. But it's not as if that's the one thing wrong with our diets. We eat way too much added sugar. We eat too much refined starch. And this key consideration, I find, John, often drops out of discussions about diet, and that is you can only have 100% of your calories every day, and that has to be made up by all the foods you eat. If you eat more of X as a percent of calories, inevitably you must eat less of Y. There's a trade-off. It can't go above 100%. So if your diet routinely includes more processed meat, say, as a percent of your total calories, that would tend to suggest that your diet includes less vegetables, fruits, whole grains, nuts, seeds, beans, lentils, for instance, as a percent of calories. And those foods are all associated with reduced risk of cancer, reduced risk of, in fact, all major chronic disease. So this is ineluctably about dietary pattern. We really can't isolate a nutrient or even a group of foods like meat because there are trade-offs in our diets.
All right, some meal mathematics there from David Katz, who definitely does not cry wolf. David Katz, physician and founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. Thanks so much, David.
Good to be with you, John. Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.